Hi there, Cory Doctorow here, and welcome to part 3 of 4 of the Return to Pleasure Island podcast, where I'm reading this story, Return to Pleasure Island, originally published in Realms of Fantasy and reprinted in my short story collection, A Place So Foreign and Eight More, published in 2003 by Four Walls, Eight Windows Press, in 4 parts. And like I said, this is part 3, and part 4 is around the corner, so you'll be getting to the end pretty soon. This story is an interesting one for me. It prefigures a lot of the stuff that happens in my novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. I thought I'd give you a little inside baseball on some of it. First of all, the creatures in this, they're golems. Some people think they're trolls, but they're golems. And their thumbs, the biting off of the thumbs to produce offspring, that's something I nicked from my pal Dave Nickel, who wrote a great story called The Unshackling of Thumbs that I workshopped in when I lived in Toronto. And it's such a cool idea that I had to enthusiastically take it away from him and make it my own. So fair notice here, fair credit for Dave. You know, that's how science fiction works. We all play with each other's ideas. Thought I'd give you a note about the names, too. The names of the three golems, Joe, George, and Bill, those are names that are historical. They're names that are assigned to people who call themselves by names that no one cares about, or that society doesn't care about. And I thought I'd give you some background there. So Joe, of course, is G.I. Joe. You know, it was the generic name for soldiers overseas, American soldiers overseas. They were all called Joe. Sometimes when an American soldier didn't want to be identified, he would tell, for example, a nice Fraulein that his name was Joe as well. George is the name that was given to black railway porters. They were all called George because that was easier than treating them like human beings and remembering their names. And Bill, well, Bill is the name that my grandfather got when he emigrated to Canada. He was born in a country that doesn't exist anymore, part of White Russia that's now part, I think, of Russia. We're not really sure, and not part of Belarus. Met my grandmother in Siberia, and then they ended up in a refugee camp in Azerbaijan where my father was born, and then came across to Canada. And his name was Avram Doktorovich. And when he got to the border, they changed it to Doktorow, Avram Doktorow. Now, you'd think that they would change Avram to Abraham, but they let it be. But it was when he got his first job, which was working as a watchmaker, that's what my grandfather's trade was, working as a watchmaker in a jewelry shop in Toronto, the guy ran it and said, you know, Avram, that's an old country name. We need to give you a contemporary name, a North American name. Let's call you Bill. And so they called him Bill, and everyone called him Bill. To the day he died, his certificate of citizenship said Abraham William Doktorow. It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing that someone could just decide that your name was too old country and just take it away from you. Headed to California next week. That's where you'll get the last installment of this from. I'm off to the O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference in San Diego, and much looking forward to it. First of all, it's a great conference, and second of all, it snowed 4 days this week in London, and I can't wait for some California sun. So enjoy part 3, and you'll hear from me in a couple of days. Bye! George started cooking dinner for 2. More and more, Joe spent the night in a suite at one of the hotels, working late. George didn't know what sort of work he was doing, but he sure seemed to enjoy it. He hardly came back to the cabin at all. The first time he'd stayed out all night, Bill had gone back to the island and gotten Orville out of bed to help him search. After that, Joe started sending out a runner, usually some poor ops trainee, to tell them when he wasn't coming back for dinner. Eventually he stopped bothering, and Bill stopped worrying. One night, a month after Orville had come out to the cabin, George slathered a muskrat's carcass with mayonnaise and lemon and dragonfly eggs and set it out for him and Bill. Bill hardly ate, which was usually a signal that he was thinking. George left him half of the dinner and waited for him to speak. Bill picked his way through the rest, then pushed his plate away. George cleared it and brought them both mason jars full of muddy water from the swamp out back. Bill took his jar out front of the cabin and leaned against the wall and stared out into the night, sipping. George joined him. "We're getting old," Bill said at last. "Every night the inside of my uniform is black," George said. "Mine too. We're getting very old. I think that you're at least 30, and I'm pretty sure that I'm 25. That's old. Our father told me that he thought he was 50, the year he died, and he was very old for one of us. George thought of their father on his deathbed, eating the food they chewed for him, eyes nearly blind, skin crazed with cracks. He was very old, George said. Bill held up his two whole hands against the stars. When father was my age, he had two sons. Can you remember how proud he was of us? How proud he was of himself? He'd done well enough that he could lose both his thumbs and still know that his sons would take care of him. George shifted and sighed. He'd been thinking about sons, too. I've wanted a son since we came to the island, Bill said. I never did anything about it, because I couldn't take care of Joe and a son. Bill turned to look at George. I think Joe's finally taking care of himself. George didn't know what to say. If Bill had a son, then he couldn't. They couldn't both stop working to raise their sons. But Bill always made the decisions for them. George didn't know what to say, so he said nothing. I'm going to have a son, Bill said. Bill did it the next night. He told Orville that he'd need a month off, and after eating the dinner that George made for them, he made a nest of earthen blankets on the floor of their cabin. George sat in the corner and watched Bill as he stared at his thumbs. It was the most important decision one of their kind ever made, a clever son of the left hand or a strong son of the right. George knew that his son would come from the left hand. In the world his father had put them into, cleverness was far more important than strength. After all, Bill was having the first son. Bill put his clever left hand in his mouth and slowly, slowly bit down. George felt muddy tears pricking at his eyes. Bill's hand coursed with silty blood. He ignored it and used his strong right hand to take the severed thumb from his mouth and bed it down with infinite care in the nest he'd built. George cautiously moved forward to look at the thumb, which was already moving blindly in its nest, twisting like a grub. Bill looked on, his eyes shining. "It's perfect," George breathed. George felt an uncharacteristic welling up inside him and put his arm around Bill's shoulders. Bill leaned into him and said, "Thank you, George. This family wouldn't exist without you." They both slept curled around the nest that night. By morning, the thumb had spread a tiny arm and leg buds, and had inched itself blindly around the nest. George marveled at it before going to work. Joe stopped by his stand that day. His belly was bigger than ever, and his skin was cracking like their father's had. "Big guy," he shouted, vaulting the counter into George's stand. "Where's Bill today? He wasn't at his post." George said, "Bill had a son last night. From the left hand." Joe rolled his eyes, which had gone the murky yellow of swamp water. "Wonderful, right? Ugh. There are better ways to achieve immortality, bro. I'm designing a crawl-through for the horror zone. You're an earthworm crawling underneath a graveyard. It's going to be huge. Maggots as big as horses chasing the guests through the tunnels. Huge ghost hands grabbing at them. We're building a giant tombstone as the weenie. You'll be able to see it from anywhere on the island. We'll build out over the midway for Horror Zone. It's the biggest rehab we've done since they brought in electric power." As usual, George didn't know what to say to Joe. "That sounds very nice," he said. George rolled his eyes again and started to say something, but stopped when three guests came up to George's booth. George hardly recognized the Mitchell brothers. The youngest was already three-quarters donkey, so dangerously close it was a miracle he hadn't been picked up already. He was hunched over, and his hands were fused into fists. His hair had grown down over his shoulders in a coarse mane, and his lips bulged around his elongated jaws. The middle and eldest were well on their ways, too. The points of their ears poked out from under their hair, and they carried themselves painfully, forcing their legs and hips upright. George flipped over his phone and punched 911, but left it out of sight below the counter. Loudly he said, "Come over here, boys. Look, you look like you could use one of George's triple dips, the best on the midway." From the phone he heard the security operator say, "Thank you, George. We'll be along in a moment." Surreptitiously, he racked the receiver and smiled at the boys. "How are you enjoying your stay, boys?" he said. "It'th awthome," the youngest said, around his clumsy teeth. George handed him a cone piled high with floss, then started building two more for his brothers. Joe smirked at them. George hoped he wouldn't say anything before security got there. The eldest said, "I don't think my brother's feeling too good. Is there a doctor here I can take him to?" The youngest, face sticky with confection, kicked his brother. "I'm fine," he said. "I want to go on more rides." His brother said, "We'll go on more rides after we see a doctor." The youngest dropped to his knees and cried, "No," he said, hammering his fists on the ground. "No, no, no, no." George watched in alarm as the boy went all the way over to Donkey. His cries turned to brays, and his shorts split around his haunches and tail. His shirt went next, and George smoothly vaulted the counter and stood in front of the donkey, blocking him from passers-by. The other two made a run for it. George snagged the middle by his collar, but the boy tore free and took off down the midway. George looked about wildly for security, but they still hadn't arrived. Then Joe tore past him, moving faster than George had ever seen him go. He caught the boys and stuffed one under each arm, kicking and squirming. He grinned ferociously as he pinned them beneath his knees at George's feet. He clamped his hands over their mouths. "Got 'em," he said to George. The security team emerged from the utilidor beside George's booth, wearing clown makeup and baggy pants. Two of them tranquilized the boys, and the third fitted the donkey out with a halter and bit. The clown slapped the donkey's haunch appreciatively. "He's a healthy one." The security team disappeared down the utilidor with the Mitchell brothers, two boys and a donkey. Joe smacked George on the back. "Did you see me catch them? Like grease lightning! Bounty, here I come!" George didn't mind sharing his bounty with Joe, so he just smiled and nodded and went back around to his booth. Bill named his son Tom. Names weren't very important to their people, but the soft ones would demand them. Within a week, Tom was eagerly toddling through their cabin, tasting everything, exploring everything. His eyes shone with a curious brilliance, the clever son of a clever son. George loved Bill's son. He loved to watch Tom as he gnawed at their bedding, as he dug at the floor in search of grubs. Tom was clearly delighted with his surroundings, and George basked in Tom's delight. Bill could barely restrain himself from picking Tom up and hugging him every moment. The only time he left George alone with Tom was a few precious moments after each evening's meal, when he would duck into the woods to find some new toy for Tom, a crippled chipmunk, a handful of pretty rocks, a discarded beer can. The son built bizarre towers out of them, then knocked them down in fits of giggles. Tom ate all day long and spoke a steady stream of adorable nonsense. Bill hardly spoke to George. Their evening meals were given over to watching the son eat. George didn't mind. Talking to the guests all day wore him out. When Tom was 2 months old, Joe came by George's booth. "Well, it's final. Tomorrow we shut down the Midway. Too old-fashioned. It's only stood this long because some of the older Imagineers had an emotional attachment to it. I told them, that's your demographic, not the target demographic. So we're knocking it down. Horror Zone's gonna be huge." He skipped off before George could say anything. His ears were long and pointed. It wasn't the first time George noticed it, but now he could see that Joe's hunched-over gait wasn't just because of his belly. George built a dozen cones for the guests, but his heart wasn't in it. Besides, most of the guests already had their hands full of gummy spiders and snakes from the Actionland Jungle Treats buffet. His thoughts were full of Joe, and he turned them over in his slow, cautious manner. Joe was turning into a donkey. He didn't think that one of their kind could turn into a donkey, but this was Pleasure Island. Indulging your vices was a dangerous pastime here. He should tell Bill, but there was no phone at the cabin. He couldn't send a runner for him, because this was family business. His shift wouldn't end for hours yet, but this was too important to wait. Finally, he called his lead. "I have to get off stage. I'm having a bad day." Technically, this was allowed. Management didn't want anyone on stage who wasn't 100%, but it was something that none of the brothers, not even Joe, had ever done. The lead was surprised, but he sent a soft one over to relieve George. Orville and Bill were sitting out front of the cabin, watching Tom, when George got back. He wrung his hands as he approached them, not sure of what to say, and whether he should talk in front of Orville at all. He held his left thumb in his right hand, and it comforted him a little. Bill and Orville were so engrossed in Tom's antics that they didn't even notice George until he cleared his throat. Orville raised his eyebrows and looked significantly at Bill. "I just saw Joe on the midway. His ears are pointed and he's walking all hunched over. I give him a few days at the most before he's all the way gone." George held his breath, waiting for Bill's reaction. "Too bad," Bill said. "It was inevitable, I suppose. A child of the tongue. What was Father thinking?" Orville smiled and puffed at his pipe. "Don't you worry about it, George. Joe's going to be much, much happier. Focused. If you'd like, I can bring him out here to live. Little Tom could have pony rides." Bill said, "I don't think that's such a good idea. Joe's too wild to play with a child." Orville put a hand on his shoulder. "You'll be amazed at how docile he'll become." Bill scooped up Tom, who was up to his waist now and who liked to grab onto Bill's nose. "We'll see, then." He retreated into the cabin with his son. Orville turned to George and said, "You've probably heard that we're taking down the midway tomorrow. The others are all being reassigned until the rehab is done, but I thought I'd see if I could get you a couple of months off. You could stay here and play with Tom. It's not every day you get to be a new uncle." Orville had always taken obvious pleasure in the transformation of the boys into donkeys. It was the whole why of Pleasure Island, after all. Orville seemed especially pleased tonight, and George thought that he was as surprised about Bill as George was. George, not knowing what to say to any of it, said nothing.